Chapter 10 Eating to Heal. In this chapter, you will learn foods rich in saturated fat, cholesterol, and salt can help improve your health. Meat and dairy products have formed the foundation of healthy human diets around the globe for millennia. The claimed links between dairy, animal foods, and salt to poor health do not stand up to close scrutiny. Tips for including these foods and nutrients in your diet. How to avoid other processed and refined ingredients that sap your energy and damage your body. How to identify foods that can resolve pathologic hunger, starting from day one. Welcome to the next phase of your culinary life, where you develop a new relationship with food, real food, the kinds of foods our human bodies all need. Right now, most people live in a nutrition paradigm that lacks a center. It's more defined by what not to eat than what we need to eat. In our current, rootless nutrition paradigm, just about every sort of food has been dressed down as the latest dietary boogeyman for one reason or another. Medical doctors tell you to avoid salt, fat, and cholesterol, while other practitioners tell you to avoid eggs, yeast, meat, nightshades, legumes, dairy, grains and wheat, sugar, and the list goes on. If we listened to all the warnings, we'd be left with a very short list of acceptable options to choose from, making it almost impossible to get the nutrition we need. The folks telling us to avoid these foods are trying to help, but they don't understand what you've just learned about vegetable oils in the last 9 chapters. If they did, they'd realize that many real foods have been wrongly blamed for problems caused by vegetable oils, and that unless we have rare digestive issues or clearly diagnosed allergies, we have nothing to fear by including these foods in our diets. Indeed, I've worked with patients who were told they needed to cut numerous foods from their diet, but were unable to do so and were left feeling hopeless about their health. Worse, some people developed illnesses or life-changing injuries stemming from protein or mineral deficiencies caused by avoiding nourishing foods. In this chapter, I want to celebrate the nourishing and delicious foods that you can feel good about enjoying. These are foods that will help to support your mitochondria, optimize hormone function, and quiet inflammation, enabling your body to restore its balance. I will also address some of the most prominent fears around salt, fat, cholesterol, dairy, and meats to help you understand why you can actually enjoy these foods in spite of the fact that many well-meaning practitioners say they're unhealthy. By the time you've finished, you'll be able to tell the difference between the factory foods that assault our biology and the real foods our bodies need. The ancestral approach. Avoiding vegetable oil and its two little siblings, refined carbohydrates and protein powders, keeps the worst ingredients out of your diet and opens up a whole lot of caloric space for healthy food. So, what can you fill it with? Some would say everything in moderation. But our healthiest ancestors did better than that, and so can we. The kind of diet I recommend is nothing like what you'll find in a typical diet book. It's not based on my own ideas. It's based on our healthiest ancestors' knowledge. It's not the latest thing or a fad. It's the oldest, most proven approach for optimal health. The ancestral approach is born of respect for the wisdom of the past, specifically the culinary principles and practices that enabled humanity to thrive across the globe. The philosophy holds that if we want to be healthy, then we need to understand how our ancestors ate. The idea is that humans have evolved to eat a certain way, and that we would be healthier if we ate similarly. This intuitive idea is also supported by science, a branch of genetics called epigenetics. Whether they followed a settled farming, nomadic herding, or hunter-gatherer lifestyle, it's thanks to our ancestors that we exist today. What's more, although the average human lifespan was shorter in times past, This was likely not due to diet, but rather to life being significantly more physically demanding, often violent, and lacking in the basic medical resources that we have today, such as antibiotics to fight infections, and anesthesia for surgeries. By all accounts, our ancestors enjoyed a far greater health span than we do today, living independent, active lives well into their eighth decade. In contrast to lifespan, which means the length of time a person or animal lives, health span refers to the span of a person's life in which they are generally in good health. In the United States, our average health span is just 66 years, 2 decades shorter than our lifespans, and it's getting shorter still with each passing generation. Two popular diets exemplify the ancestral philosophy, the paleo and carnivore diets. Both aim to mimic the diets of our ancient ancestors, specifically those who lived as hunter-gatherers during, for example, the Paleolithic era, which ended around 10,000 years ago. That said, these diets are based on relatively limited evidence. Although anthropologists have uncovered thousands of artifacts widely scattered across every continent, except Antarctica, it's still very difficult to guess what these ancient people actually ate. More to the point, the paleo diet philosophy also assumes that human health has been in decline since the end of the Paleolithic period, which may not be true. There's another, more practical ancestral approach that has advantages over paleo, and which I prefer. It's a more modern-day ancestral approach. The approach doesn't assume we need to go back so far in time to rid ourselves of chronic disease. We can instead emulate our more recent pre-industrial ancestors who lived before our disease epidemics began. Over the course of my career, I have evaluated 80 such pre-industrial cuisines around the world and identified the strategies common to all of them, which I call the four pillars of a human diet. 1. Eat fresh, uncooked food. 2. Eat meat. Include recipes that slow cook skin, tendons, and bones to extract the special nutrients in these collagenous tissues, for example, bone broth. 3. Eat fermented and sprouted foods, including yogurt, kefir, kombucha, kimchi, and sprouted nuts, seeds, and beans. 4. Eat nose to tail, making use of all the animal's organs. Keep in mind, our ancestors ate animals that enjoyed a species-appropriate diet and time in the sunshine, outdoors, and they survived by extracting as much nutrition as they could from the landscapes wherever they lived and in every form possible, be it animal, vegetable, or mineral. This is what we've done for hundreds of thousands of years, and it is what we still need to do to build healthy human bodies and keep them running right. Macronutrient ranges. I often get asked, what portion of daily calories, the macronutrients, for example, the fat, carbs, and protein, should represent? And here too, we can look to ancestral wisdom for guidance. The answer for you, personally, varies depending on your metabolic health. When we are metabolically healthy, we can tolerate a wider range of macros. If not, we need to be stricter with our carbohydrate intake. Here are my recommendations for each situation. Fat calories, 50 to 80% of your daily total. Carb calories. With moderate insulin resistance, HOMA-IR score 2.5 or over, 15 to 20% of your daily total, roughly 50 to 100 grams. It's important to divide these between at least 2 meals instead of eating them all in 1 meal. With mild or no insulin resistance, HOMA-IR score 2.4 or less, 0 to 40% of your daily total, roughly 0 to 150 grams. Protein calories, 15 to 25% of your daily total, roughly 60 to 150 grams. Note, see the supplementary PDF for information on HOMA-IR testing. This breakdown is based on our ancestral eating patterns. Our ancestral diets range most widely in terms of carbs, and not surprisingly, there are more disagreements about high versus low carb than almost anything else in the nutrition world. Remember, people used to eat what was available to them where they lived. Since protein and fat-rich animals were generally abundant year-round, but plants were not, the macro that comes from plants, carbohydrate, varied the most. There's a lot of anxiety about this macronutrient, but the truth is that what matters to our metabolic recovery is building meals that prevent pathologic hunger, and a wide range of total carbs can do that. The kind of carbs, however, matter a good deal, and we'll discuss those later in this chapter. First up, though, are those healthy fats we've been discussing. Fat, our connection to health and culinary riches. The only kind of fat that I recommend against is vegetable oil. Otherwise, fat is part of a healthy diet. For a detailed list of good and bad fats, including questions on cooking and more, see Chapter 9. Most people who lived through the 1980s and 1990s have such an ingrained fear that fat will make them fat, or coat their arteries, or clog their hearts, and have spent so many years avoiding it that it just seems bizarre to start seeking it out. Fat does indeed have more calories than sugar, so pound for pound, it will be more fattening. But fat is more satiating than sugar, so you're more likely to eat less of it. And as we saw in Chapter 5, fat will neither clog nor coat your arteries. The modern nutrition paradigm has convinced us that these life-giving sources of nutrients are going to riddle us with disease, thus separating us from our collective cultural wisdom. This is tragic. Historical culinary practices represent a great body of nutritional wisdom that enabled us to survive in every corner of the globe. Animal fats were central to culinary practices the world over. By dutifully avoiding these fats, we've deprived ourselves of many foods our ancestors enjoyed, and that enabled them to have healthy children and build healthy, resilient, beautiful human bodies. Fat won't coat your arteries. Why would Mother Nature tempt us to eat fatty foods that would build up in our arteries? Answer, she doesn't. But that's exactly what Ansel Keys actually tried to suggest when he said, famously, that fat builds up in your arteries like hot grease in a cold pipe. That is simply not how the body works. In Chapter 5, I briefly mentioned that your body has fat delivery vehicles called lipoproteins that deliver cholesterol throughout your tissues so it can do its job. These vehicles can be destroyed by oxidation, however. As we've discussed, both smoking and seed oils will oxidize our lipoproteins and build plaques in our arteries. If you avoid both, your arteries can start to heal. You might think we should avoid eating fat, so we have less fat in our arteries. While that's true with vegetable oils, avoiding the healthy fat tends to increase the amount of triglyceride fat in the blood. Both vegetable oils and carbohydrates, particularly fructose sugar, reliably elevate our blood levels of triglyceride fat. High triglycerides are associated with arterial fat and heart attacks, so this is not a good thing. Benefits of healthy fats. Energy. Saturated and monounsaturated rich foods are ideal mitochondrial fuels. They help to prevent the hypoglycemia symptoms that disrupt brain function and drive so many people to snack. Including healthy fats in our meals helps our mitochondria heal. Metabolic healing. By providing fuels that heal our mitochondria, we start to restore a normal blood sugar set point. This is the key to metabolic health, and in combination with proper carbohydrate consumption, it will reverse diabetes and insulin resistance. Flavor. Every real chef will tell you fat is flavor. And the truly enlightened chefs will tell you that vegetable oil is the exception to that rule. Vegetable oil kills flavor. Sure, when you deep-fry starchy foods such as French fries or batter-coated shrimp in vegetable oil, that hot crispness can make for a satisfying crunch. But if you take the same ingredients and deep-fry them in a cuisine-appropriate fat, such as tallow, or even pan-fry them in butter, I can guarantee the taste will be superior. Tips for including healthy fats in your meals. Cook with healthy fats, the delightful dozen I listed in Chapter 9. Use butter, cream, cheese, and dairy fat, including whole milk and whole milk yogurt. You can cook foods in butter, add cream cheese instead of jelly to a peanut butter sandwich, and add extra cream to your coffee instead of fake creamer or milk. Cheese, cottage cheese, and yogurt make for excellent additions to lean meats such as fish and chicken. They are also good as standalone meals or even desserts. Use avocados, coconuts, and nuts, especially almonds, pecans, hazelnuts, and peanuts. Learn which animals have the highest quality fats. Some animal fats are relatively high in PUFA, and their higher PUFA content can contribute to a state of PUFA overload, which is not ideal. Ideally, the animals you buy would also be fed such that their PUFA content is relatively low. Sadly, most of our feedlot pigs, poultry, and farmed fish eat high PUFA corn and soy-based pellets. Unless stated otherwise, the list starts with animals with the highest PUFA content first, and PUFA descends as you go down the list, assuming a typical feedlot scenario. Farmed fatty fish. The fatty acids in farmed salmon or other fatty fish will vary wildly, since the feed varies wildly. It's best avoided. Low-fat fish won't have enough fat to worry about this particular issue. Chicken. Chicken has more PUFA than red meats. Pasture-raised chicken is a better choice if available to you. Pork. There's a big difference between confinement-fed pork and pork-fed a species-appropriate diet. A pig in the wild will eat grubs, mushrooms, nuts, especially acorns, in addition to fresh greens. The flavor will reflect its diet, too. Even though pork can be delicious when raised in confinement and fed pelleted corn and soy, it's nothing like what pork tastes like when properly raised. If you have money burning a hole in your pocket, you should try forest-raised pork or Iberico pork from a traditional breed native to the Iberian Peninsula. Both will also be much lower in PUFA. This doesn't matter much for lean cuts, such as tenderloin, but it matters a great deal for bacon, pork belly, and other delights. Beef. Cows can consume a relatively high PUFA diet, but still produce low PUFA body fat. Cows that get grass and other natural cow forage are healthier themselves and more nutritious for us. Lamb. Lamb cannot be raised on grain or even indoors, so all lamb is technically grass-fed and pasture-raised. Because of this, lamb is relatively low in PUFA and relatively high in micronutrients, too. Benefits of cholesterol-rich foods, rejuvenation unchained. Years of cholesterol-lowering seed oil consumption has suppressed some people's total body cholesterol to the point that it has suppressed their sex hormones, cortisol, and even DHEA, or dehydroepiandrosterone, a precursor to hormones such as estrogen and testosterone that is commonly sold as an anti-aging supplement. Our bodies can make cholesterol, but if our cholesterol production has been suppressed for years, it can take some time before our ability to make cholesterol ramps up again. Seeking out cholesterol-rich foods can rejuvenate our hormone levels and help to jumpstart our metabolic recovery. I've seen men in their 50s and 60s triple their testosterone levels, and women of various ages normalize their menstrual cycles or dramatically reduce perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms, including mood swings and hot flashes. Cholesterol is not a fat. Our bodies cannot use it for energy. Still, it suppresses pathologic hunger by two important mechanisms. How cholesterol-rich foods prevent hunger. Satiety. Cholesterol is such an important nutrient that nature has seen fit to make it one of the most satiating chemicals in the edible world. You could say it's satiety on steroids. This is why eating just 3 or 4 eggs feels like plenty. While most of us need many more calories of sugary, high-carb foods, such as oatmeal, muffins, donuts, or fruit, to feel equally full. 3 eggs have just 180 calories, but 561 milligrams cholesterol, and can sustain most people all morning. A Dunkin' apple and spiced donut has 230 calories and 0 cholesterol, and often it sustains you for just an hour or so. Incidentally, at least a dozen large epidemiological studies and clinical interventions involving tens of thousands of people have shown that people who eat 6 or more eggs per week live longer and have fewer heart attacks than people who avoid eggs. Ketones. Cholesterol-rich foods help support your body's ability to make ketones. The liver is a main source of both cholesterol and ketones, but it cannot make both at the same time. Remember, ketones are made specifically for the brain, which can't use body fat. And studies show that ketones are superior to fueling with sugar. Ketones powerfully suppress hunger, especially pathologic hunger, and will keep us from getting distracted by thoughts of snacks lurking elsewhere nearby. So on a low cholesterol diet, the liver is busy making cholesterol, which deprives us of ketones and all the good they do. Tips for including cholesterol-rich foods in your diet. Eggs. You can eat as many as you like. The healthiest way to cook an egg is to poach it or soft boil it. If you fry it, leave the yellow part runny. Use butter for best flavor. Liver, chicken, beef, etc. I recommend getting 4 to 8 ounces of liver per week. More important than the type of animal is how healthy it was, which you can estimate by looking at the liver's color. Dark maroons are better than pale or dull browns. Crustaceans. Lobster, shrimp, crab. The healthiest way to cook these is to steam them or gently, quickly fry them in healthy fat. Dairy fat and animal fat. These are great sources of cholesterol, as well as the healthy fats mentioned in Chapter 9. Knowing your proteins. We need protein for more than just muscle building. We need it for every cell in every organ in our bodies. Our mitochondria need protein to make the antioxidant enzymes that control oxidative stress. Protein plays an essential role in health and your metabolic recovery. Yet here in the United States, a third of adults over the age of 50 do not get enough protein, and roughly half of all people with diabetes are significantly protein deficient, according to data from the 2005 to 2016 National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Protein deficiency is far more common than most people realize because doctors are not well trained to diagnose it. For example, hair loss, nail breakage, and low white blood cell counts are all known to be signs of malnutrition. And I've seen many cases where these issues resolve with adding protein. Short stature, low peak bone density, leading to osteopenia and osteoporosis, and low muscle mass are lifelong consequences of inadequate protein in childhood. Lower protein intake correlates with shorter male height in 105 countries studied. Low protein intake contributes to both the development of type 2 diabetes and to mortality in people who already have diabetes, especially for those over the age of 60. The most worrisome aspect of the protein discussion is that the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Dietary Reference Intake, or DRI, is likely a whopping 40 to 50% too low. The government's recommended daily allowance, or RDA, guidelines were set back in the 1940s, before we understood protein metabolism as well as we do now. According to New Science, those older techniques significantly underestimated how much protein we need. Flawed nitrogen balance equations led to this egregious underestimation, and governmental agencies have not reset their recommendations based on the newer, better calculations. Most people need a minimum of 60 to 100 grams per day. To more accurately estimate your protein needs and intake, see the calculator in the supplementary PDF. If these numbers seem low to you, keep in mind that websites listing higher protein intakes are often designed for bodybuilders who are trying to hack their biology to make it look a certain way, which is not the same as seeking health. Protein and politics. Before we jump into the next section on healthy, high-protein foods, I want to address the arguments that often come up in discussions about our protein needs, particularly the idea that eating animals is bad for the environment and that meat causes cancer. Let's look at the environmental concern first. These days, there's a common feeling that we should all be eating lower on the food chain, and especially avoiding beef because cows promote global warming. These arguments put the cart before the horse. We need to first get clear on our nutritional needs. If we need more protein than the government is currently recommending, and if red meat is one of the most healthful foods in the food system, then cutting these foods will have health consequences that need to be considered and discussed as part of the conversation. Right now, that is not happening. The assumption is that we eat too much protein, and we can safely cut down. But a good portion of the population appears to not get enough protein, especially thin people, including thin children and pregnant women, health-conscious people, people trying to lose weight, and people over 50, and their health is suffering as a result. Our health authorities are misleading us into believing that we can all do fine, living on a completely novel diet of highly processed ingredients derived from just a few monoculture crops, mostly wheat, corn, soy, rice, and potatoes, as long as we throw in a few fresh fruits and vegetables. This is the trajectory we have been on for decades, and our health is collapsing. If we want to address either the climate concerns or the animal welfare concerns, we need to have an honest discussion about the big picture. The fact is, if we continue on our current trajectories with our food systems and our health, both will collapse. Ecologists warn that all industrial-scale agriculture, whether it produces cows or wheat, disrupts the soil, and our continued reliance on it is unraveling the vital threads connecting the systems that support life. Our health has always depended ultimately on the health of the soil, and ecologists are trained to understand all the various interconnected earth systems that contribute to healthy soil. Today, many ecologists are saying that animals are part of the solution to our climate crisis. Experts have identified farming and ranching practices that can actually put carbon in the soil, seemingly more efficiently than any other method so far identified. These methods also boost the productivity of the soil and the diversity of the ecosystem, while simultaneously improving animal health and welfare. Thus, their solutions can also benefit human health. Simply cutting out animal products and turning to all plant-based foods doesn't solve the problems that giant factory farms introduce. Animal-based protein has somewhat followed in the footsteps of cholesterol, in that our health authorities make concerning claims that discourage us from eating it. But how valid are those claims? Let's look at the concern that meat causes cancer. In the early 2010s, the World Health Organization, or WHO, convened a working group of 22 experts from 10 countries to study the available evidence on a possible connection between cancer and meat. Both mammalian muscle meat, including beef, veal, pork, lamb, mutton, horse, and goat, and processed meat, meaning meat from any animal, not just red meats, but also poultry, fish, shellfish, and so on, that has been transformed through salting, curing, fermentation, smoking, or other processes to enhance flavor or improve preservation. By 2015, the working group came to the conclusion that red meat will give you cancer. Sort of. Well, maybe. Red meat was added to their short list of group 2A carcinogens, defined as probably carcinogenic to humans. To be clear, WHO is not saying we know red meat causes cancer in humans. There's no evidence for that. The working group found a faint statistical link between meat eating and cancer. And so it looked at animal studies to see if there was a plausible mechanism by which red meat might generate cancer. The team claimed that there was. But let's take a look at a few key details upon which this determination hinged. The pertinent part of the report refers to several dozen animal studies. Some of these studies used mice genetically prone to developing a kind of non-cancerous tumor, called an adenoma. In these studies, beef increased the number of adenomas. But adenomas are not cancers, and these beef-eating adenoma-forming mice did not get cancer. It's not clear how a study of mice bred to form adenomas would translate to humans even if they did. The report also cites numerous rat studies that used tumor-prone rats. And in these studies, red meat failed to cause cancer unless other foods were blended into their meat. Those foods were margarine and corn oil. I think they should have mentioned that you can only make red meat cause cancer by blending it with some kind of seed oil-based food. WHO has also said that charred red meat cooked on an open flame may be the real problem, not red meat cooked without charring. Charred meat has been partially burnt, creating flecks of black burned meat, like grill marks. The concern is that this burned material may contain carcinogenic compounds from a family of chemicals called heterocyclic amines and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. However, the doses used in these studies were equivalent to thousands of times the doses that a person would consume in a normal diet, according to the National Cancer Institute and others. In other words, it appears that the only way these carcinogenic chemicals can actually give animals cancer is when they get them in concentrations thousands of times greater than anyone could possibly eat, even if they lived off nothing but charred red meat. One last point. What causes charring? Oxidation. So, if we are willing to consider the health effects of oxidation in animal foods like red meat, then we should be willing to consider the health effects of oxidation in the plant-derived seed oils. Next, let's discuss what the WHO report says about the link between processed meat and cancer. The working group determined that processed meat is a group 1 carcinogen, meaning it is known that this substance causes cancer in humans. So, let's look at what the data showed. First, the statistical link between processed meat and cancer is barely even there. Processed meat has only been statistically linked to only one type of cancer, colorectal, not esophageal, not stomach, not oral, etc. I get very suspicious when a supposed cancer-causing agent is only linked to a very specific subtype of cancer. That's because if a compound is truly carcinogenic, it causes cancer in most tissues, not just a select few. Second, it turns out that the colon cancer risk level rises only a small amount, even if you eat processed meat like hot dogs every day of the year. Most of us do not. For a man at an average 5% risk, a daily hot dog increases that risk to 5.8%. Finally, according to a study that dove into some important details, processed meat does not give women cancer, no matter how much they eat. That same study also found that the men who got cancer were more likely to smoke cigarettes than the men who did not get cancer, which again implicates oxidation as the true issue. Another study found a strong link between processed meat consumption, ultra-processed food consumption, and once more, cigarette smoking. In summary, the link between these meats and cancer is not there. And the links between oxidation, seed oils, and cancer seem to have been suppressed. I'd like to wrap up this discussion by pointing out that WHO also states that red meat is good for children and pregnant women, citing it as a good source of protein, iron, and zinc. Children and pregnant moms who avoid red meat are more likely to be deficient in one or more of these key nutrients. As a result, WHO recommends introducing red meat into a child's diet, starting at the age of 6 months. In other words, WHO recommends red meat for infants and pregnant women, while at the same time warning everyone else not to eat it because it may cause cancer. Is it that red meat is good for us at certain phases of life and bad at others? Of course not. Insects may need different nutrients throughout their lifespan, starting out as grubs or larvae, before metamorphosing into creatures with legs and wings. But we don't do that. As humans, we have the exact same organs throughout our lives, and the same, or very similar, nutritional needs too. So, now that we've addressed those common concerns, let's look at how to ensure we're getting enough protein. Good protein. Whole food, animal, and plant sources of protein. The best sources of protein are whole foods. The best whole food sources are going to come from animal proteins, which include not only the muscle meats of land and water animals, but also many organ meats. Animal proteins are superior to plant proteins due to the simple fact that our bodies are made from identical building blocks to those of mammals and fish. Plants are built of different building blocks, and thus it requires more careful planning and much more dietary restriction to get enough protein from them. Moreover, since many high-protein plant foods are actually high PUFA seeds, as explained later in this chapter, it's more difficult to avoid PUFA on a plant-based diet. Animal-based protein. Beef. All cuts of beef are great, including ground beef, steaks, stew meat, ribs, tails, and the organs, such as liver, tongue, tripe, and heart. Bone marrow is often very fatty, making it lower protein. The best beef is going to come from grass-finished cattle. Note that 100% grass-fed meat does taste different from grain-fed and requires adjusting your cooking technique to bring out its best flavors. You can find plenty of good guidance online. See the supplementary PDF for a few web pages that I like. Chicken. All kinds of chicken parts are great. Breast, thighs, legs, wings, back, and of course whole roasted or rotisserie chicken. The best chicken is going to come from chickens given access to pasture, bugs, and sunlight. Skin on, bone in, has more flavor and more nutrition. Crustaceans. All crustaceans sold as food are great. Crab, crayfish, lobster, prawns, shrimp, mollusks, clams, oysters, and scallops. Many crustaceans are excellent sources of cholesterol, which makes them very satiating. The healthiest way to cook them is to steam them or gently and quickly fry them in healthy fat. Dairy. High-protein dairy products include milk, yogurt, cottage cheese, and cheese. Duck. Everything I just said about chicken applies to duck. Eggs. Hailed as the perfect food, eggs are great sources of protein and cholesterol and are very satiating. The best eggs come from the best chickens, ducks, and so on, meaning they had access to fresh air and a species-appropriate diet. Fish. All fish are great, and every part of the fish you can make use of is also great. Popular fish include salmon, catfish, cod, flounder, halibut, tuna, mackerel, bass, trout, walleye, and mahi-mahi. The best fish are going to be wild-caught. Even tilapia can be healthy when it's not farmed. Farmed fish, unfortunately, can be quite full of industrial contaminants. Lamb. As with beef, all cuts of lamb are great. Pork. As with beef and lamb, all cuts are great. Turkey. Everything I said about chicken and duck applies to turkey. Other. Less popular but very healthy high-protein animal foods include venison, goose, eel, buffalo, ostrich, rabbit, guinea pig, and quail. Dairy. The original superfood. Milk is the only food that nature intended for the sole purpose of nourishing our bodies. Dairy is a superfood that supports bone and dental health and helps us build muscle. It's a natural source of vitamin B12 and healthy omega-3 fatty acids. It is also a complex food with many components that people can develop allergies or intolerances to, a fact that often convinces people we shouldn't be eating it at all. But that is no more an indication that everyone should avoid milk than the fact that many people are allergic to fish, eggs, wheat, and soy means everyone should avoid these foods. It's worth noting that as more processed foods enter our food supply, more of us are developing allergies to components of those processed foods, including milk. Another problem people have with milk that is not allergy-related is lactose intolerance. Lactose is the main sugar in milk. When you are lactose intolerant, the lactose does not get absorbed into your bloodstream, but stays in your intestine, where it can cause bloating, cramping, and even diarrhea. When we're born, we have a special enzyme to break down lactose and bring it into our bodies called lactase. This enzyme goes away after we stop drinking mother's milk, historically by age 5. After age 5, it's normal to be lactose intolerant. Most of the world's population is. And yet people on every continent enjoy a variety of dairy products because they enjoy mostly fermented dairy. Fermented dairy includes things like yogurt, cheese, and sour cream, and traditional foods such as labneh, a kind of strained yogurt, and kefir. During fermentation, microbial cultures consume the lactose sugar, fermenting some or all of it away. The longer the ferment, the less lactose remains. Cheeses like cheddar, parmesan, and Swiss, which are very low in lactose, are the best choices for people with troublesome lactose intolerance issues. Fermented dairy is a great way to ensure a proper protein intake. Plant-based protein. The best plant sources of protein come from the seeds. What botanists would refer to as seeds fall into a variety of categories of foods, including nuts, beans, grains, and what we call seeds in everyday parlance. Plant-based foods with the highest protein levels are as follows. Seitan, 80% protein. Tempeh, 45% protein. Extra firm tofu, 40% protein. Lupini beans dry, 39% protein. Edamame, cooked, 36% protein. Japanese black soybeans, dry, 33% protein. Split peas, dry, 29% protein. Oat bran, dry, 27% protein. Lima beans, dry, 25% protein. Black lentils, dry, 25% protein. Pumpkin seeds, dry, 22% protein. Hemp hearts, raw, 22% protein. Japanese soba or buckwheat noodles, dry, 21% protein. Spelt or whole grain, raw, 17% protein. Wheat berries, raw, 17% protein. Wild rice, dry, 17% protein. Amaranth, dry, 17% protein. Peanuts, dry roasted, 16% protein. Buckwheat groats, raw, 16% protein. Pistachios, dry roasted, 15% protein. Quinoa, raw, 15% protein. Almonds, raw, 15% protein. Sunflower seeds, raw, 15% protein. Bulgur wheat, whole grain, raw, 14% protein. Teff, raw, 14% protein. Cashews, raw, 13% protein. Hazelnuts, raw, 10% protein. Brazil nuts, raw, 9% protein. Walnuts, raw, 9% protein. Notice that the highest protein plant-based items in the list are all traditional foods. Seitan, tempeh, tofu. Ancestral food processing practices typically concentrate an ingredient's nutrients, unlike modern food processing. It's especially notable that this was accomplished thousands of years before anyone knew the term protein. Know your carbs. Carbs will play an important role in your metabolic recovery because when we're insulin resistant, our bodies need more sugar than is normal to avoid burning muscle protein for energy. But we are also more susceptible to sugar spikes and harmful aging of our tissues as a result. So it's really a delicate balancing act. By eating the right types of carbs at the right time, we can keep our blood sugar steady, keep our brains functioning better, and reduce the wastage of muscle and dietary protein. If you're trying to lose weight, you may be tempted to go all in on cutting carbs, but try to shift that all-or-none mindset from carbs generally to the refined carbs and carb bombs discussed later. Slow digesting carbs. Get the energy without the insulin. Slow digesting carbs are more nutritious and take a longer time to digest than refined carbohydrates. Dietitians often call these low glycemic carbs, but I prefer the term slow digesting because it more accurately describes why they do what they do. As they trickle out of the digestive system into the bloodstream over the course of several hours, slow digesting carbs provide a steady supply of sugar to sugar-dependent cells, preventing the blood sugar spike as well as the insulin spike. They also prevent the insulin spike-induced blood sugar dip that makes people feel hungry and tired a few hours later. Slow digesting carbs. Slow digesting carbs fall into five categories: whole grains, beans, nuts and seeds, semi-starchy vegetables, select fruits. The slowest of the slow are nuts and seeds and semi-starchy vegetables. We've already discussed that refined flours and sugars have an insulin-spiking, energy-crashing effect. But any highly processed grain, including quick-cooking oatmeal, can do the same thing, as can rice, potatoes, and most fruits. These foods are basically carb bombs, bred for thousands of years to be a source of calories. As a result, they now offer very little nutrition relative to other whole foods, so it's best to limit them while we're trying to recover from insulin resistance. While they are not off the menu entirely, you'll see that they don't appear very often in the 2-week challenge. You'll also notice that where they do appear, they're paired with foods that contain fat, protein, and fiber. Just as the fiber, fat, and protein in something like a peanut slows down the absorption of the carbohydrate component within a given food, the same applies within a given meal. For example, by itself, an apple might spike your blood sugar by, say, 30 points or so, likely higher if you have diabetes. Spreading peanut butter on the two halves of an apple can cut such spikes in half. We can slow the absorption of rice used in a stir fry by adding plenty of bok choy, celery, snap peas, eggs, shrimp, and peanuts. A slice of dry toast might spike blood sugar by 35 points, but scooping some scrambled eggs onto the toast could cut that in half. These food combining tricks even work for junk, like soda and candy, but not very well. They work much better and in some cases prevent spikes entirely when used with whole grains, beans, and the specific breads and fruits I recommend later. Everyone's response to carbs and combinations of carbs with other foods is a little different. Remember, the goal is to suppress your pathologic hunger and prevent hypoglycemia symptoms between meals, not to predict exactly what's happening with your blood sugar. If you have either prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, it can be helpful to test blood sugar after eating carbohydrate-containing foods to make sure you're not spiking your sugar. And if you do see a blood sugar spike, you will know to make different choices or reduce the amounts in the future. The new continuous glucometer, or CGM technology, makes understanding how different foods affect blood sugar easy and fun. You usually need a doctor's prescription to buy one. However, a few tech companies have found a workaround for this. See the resources section in the supplementary PDF. Soaking and germinating. Soaking and germinating enhances the nutritional value of all seeds, including grains. You can buy nuts and seeds that have been activated in this way already. They cost more than raw or roasted, but they taste better and are better for you. Buying dry beans and soaking them at least overnight is healthier than buying canned. Draining after the soaking process and allowing them to germinate for an additional 24 or so hours further enhances their nutritional value. Good sources of slow-digesting carbs. Sprouted grain breads. Sprouting awakens enzymes in the seeds that convert storage glucose to vitamins, fiber, and amino acids. These are the healthiest breads you can buy. They're sold in the freezer section because they contain no preservatives and mold quickly, so keep them in your fridge. They are flavorful and coarse, and they take some getting used to if you've always eaten fluffy bread. Toasting helps. Yellow corn tortillas. These types of tortillas are made with corn masa, which is slightly less processed than flour, and therefore slightly healthier and cause less of a spike in blood sugar. They're also generally smaller than flour tortillas, so the dose of carb is lower. When I say yellow corn tortillas, however, I do not mean the hard taco shells that are sold in a box, which are usually made with vegetable oil. Beans. All beans are healthy. The most popular varieties are lima, kidney, black, pinto, split pea, cannellini, and garbanzo. I don't recommend the newfangled bean-based pastas, however, since they're generally highly processed and suspiciously flavorless. Whole grains. These include wheat, oats, rye, barley, buckwheat, quinoa, and wild rice. Nuts. Popular nuts include peanuts and tree nuts, such as almonds, pecans, cashews, walnuts, macadamia nuts, Brazil nuts, pistachios, and hazelnuts. Nut butters. All nut butters are great, including peanut butter, almond butter, or any nut butter. The best kind of peanut butter is the kind you can grind yourself right in the store. The next best is all natural with no added oils or sugars. But the natural oil does separate and get annoying. Skippy and Jif both offer peanut butter options without added sugar that use palm oil to prevent separation. Seeds. These can be high in omega-3, but also high in total PUFA. The best seeds are pumpkin seeds. Other seeds, such as sunflower and chia, may best be consumed after you've been off seed oils for long enough that your biomarkers have improved. Semi-starchy vegetables. Most vegetables are very low carb and don't sustain our energy on their own. Potatoes and corn are very high carb, and I don't recommend eating them on a regular basis. Peas, pumpkin, cooked carrots, and winter squashes, such as butternut and acorn squash, represent a middle category that can sustain our energy all by themselves without producing a big blood sugar spike. Even so, it's still better to combine these with healthy fats. Anything fruit can do, vegetables can do better. The many varieties of vegetables, besides the semi-starchy ones we've just covered, are naturally low in carbs and packed with nutrition. In general, you can feel good about choosing vegetables. Potatoes are the only vegetable I recommend particular caution with. That said, there are a few things to keep in mind with these plant foods. Watch the sugar content of fruits. Most fruit today is so full of sugar that getting the vitamins and minerals you need from fruit will come along with hundreds more sugary calories than the same amount of vitamins and minerals from vegetables. The best fruits for metabolic rehab are not the sweetest ones. In fact, the less sweet, the better. Avocados, cranberries, currants, and coconuts are the best. Berries and melons are also low in sugar. Blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, cantaloupe, honeydew, and watermelon are great choices. It's best to use fruit to flavor other, more nutritious foods than to eat it all by itself. My advice to patients has long been to limit their intake of fruit based on how much sugar it contains. A good upper limit is 20 grams of sugar, and I wouldn't push it to the max every day. That would be one banana, orange, grapefruit, apple, peach, or pear, about half a mango or papaya, about 3/4 of a cup of grapes, about 2 cups of watermelon or cantaloupe, or only about 1 ounce of dried fruit, such as raisins, banana chips, or dried cherries. I like to think of fruit as a spice. You can add it to a dish to make it flavorful and give something savory that element of sweetness, or use it as a dessert. Having fruit as your meal without any accompaniment is very likely to make you feel hungry again a short while later. Pair low-carb vegetables with fat and/or protein. Most low-carb vegetables are extremely nutritious, but bear in mind that most of them are also too low in calories to sustain our energy. Be sure to consume them as a side dish or otherwise accompanied by some healthy fats and/or protein. Examples of low-carb vegetables include all lettuces and salad greens, celery, spinach, radishes, kale, peppers, tomatoes, broccoli, cauliflower, green beans, asparagus, and fresh herbs. When shopping for vegetables, it's important to consider that many of them do not last more than a week in the fridge. If you don't like shopping at least once a week, you can get frozen vegetables, and the vegetables that tend to keep a little longer, including carrots, onions, and celery. Leafy greens like lettuce, arugula, baby greens, and kale tend to go bad quickly, so plan accordingly. For vitamin C, bell peppers beat orange juice every day of the week. Organic is important, sort of. Testing shows that certified organic fruits and vegetables are generally lower in toxic pesticide and herbicide residues, as well as other environmental contaminants, as you would hope. But this may be less important than whether the produce is fresh and tastes like it should. How much carb is too much? I don't recommend piles of starchy carbs as the centerpiece of a meal. Instead of a plate of pasta, make it a side. Instead of a heaping pile of mashed potatoes, take a smaller portion. Rice, corn, and potatoes are full of relatively empty calories, and when combined with butter and salt, can be so delicious that it's too easy to overeat them. Brown rice is not significantly more nutritious than white rice. Sweet potatoes have an undeserved reputation for being healthier than white potatoes. They are not. If weight is not a concern for you, and you have not been diagnosed with prediabetes or diabetes, then you can enjoy more of these foods. Just be sure you're not eating so much that they've displaced the nutritious foods your body actually needs. If you have moderate insulin resistance or diabetes, it's best to limit your added sugars as much as possible. I recommend 1 teaspoon or less per day. Flour is best used as a thickener for healthy bone stock gravies and to coat very healthy foods, like liver, before pan frying. Sugars are best thought of as a spice to be used to flavor otherwise nutritious dishes. Timing your sweets and carbs. The worst time of day to have anything sweet is in the morning. Sweetness is more addicting at that time and more damaging to the metabolism. The reasons have to do with hormonal circadian rhythms. The same goes for starchy foods that are not sweet, such as breads, bagels, quick cooking oats, and the like. Although these are common breakfast items, they are also a common cause of mid-morning hunger and hypoglycemia. Keep in mind that if you feel you cannot stay in control, they are best avoided. Beyond macros, salt, herbs, and spices are powerful health allies. Aside from nourishing healthy fats, protein, and carbs, I'd like to discuss a few other foods here because while they are not the main components of our meals, they can impart healthful properties and make our meals more enjoyable. I'm referring to salt, herbs, and spices. Salt is an antioxidant. We like salty flavors because they indicate the presence of minerals and antioxidants. One of the little-known facts about sodium chloride, or table salt, is that it is a potent antioxidant, effectively preventing oxidation not only in our foods, but also in our bloodstream. Our blood is very salty, and nature puts salt there to help fight the oxidation that would otherwise damage our arteries. Salt gets a bad rap, and as with red meat, we often hear we are eating too much of it. But our bodies regulate the salt content of our blood. If we eat too much of it, we get thirsty, which helps our kidneys eliminate the extra amount. It's actually quite hard to eat too much salt because when we oversalt our food, it's generally so unpalatable that we simply won't eat it. On the other hand, chronic salt deprivation while consuming caffeinated beverages or taking certain medications can lower our sodium levels to the point that we feel absolutely miserable. Unnecessarily avoiding salt causes a staggering amount of unnecessary suffering. Between 3 million and 6 million people visit their doctors, and roughly 1 million are hospitalized annually because of low blood sodium levels. Virtually nobody is admitted to the hospital because of high blood sodium, unless they have another serious issue that is causing it, such as severe dehydration or kidney failure. Salt and blood pressure. Dietary surveys have linked salt consumption to high blood pressure. But in doing these analyses, the researchers generally just tally up the salt and pay no attention to what else came along with it. Since processed foods are both heavily salted and laden with seed oils, when you get your salt from processed foods, you're also getting plenty of toxic oils and refined carbs. Furthermore, since health-conscious people avoid salt unnecessarily, people who eat the most salt are generally eating poorly overall. These methodological flaws completely confound the results. It makes it look like salt is the problem, when the real problem is processed foods. If you pay close attention, you will notice experts don't usually say salt actually causes hypertension, because there is no evidence of this. The American Heart Association's website says salt may worsen hypertension, emphasis mine. It does not say that it does. Just to be clear, if you don't have hypertension, no one can even make the claim that you will benefit by avoiding salt. However, even the claim that salt may worsen hypertension is questionable. Clinical trials have tested the idea that lowering salt intake improves blood pressure. And while some have shown it works, many have not. The more likely reason that a low-salt diet shows any benefit has to do with the fact that participants in these studies aren't just eating less salt, but are also given a salt substitute made with minerals that many folks don't get enough of, including magnesium sulfate or potassium chloride. They also benefit by meeting weekly with dietitians who tell them to eat less junk. So while all the focus in these studies is on salt, the real health benefits are probably coming from the other variables that get less attention. Note, if you have severe heart or kidney failure, then you do need to restrict salt intake. These organs regulate the body's balance of salt, water, and many minerals. When they are failing, everything needs to be calculated and monitored, including not just salt, but also water, potassium, and phosphate. Chefs often say that their number one secret ingredient is liberal use of salt. Junk food manufacturers notoriously use fat, salt, and umami flavors to make foods incredibly delicious. Umami is the savory flavor we get from, for example, soy sauce, fish sauce, miso, cooked mushrooms, browned butter, and Worcestershire sauce. Obesity experts warn that salt, umami, and fake flavors make processed foods hyperpalatable, meaning they taste so good that we can't stop eating them. But the reason we can't stop eating them is that the artificial fats and fake proteins don't provide real satiety. So why not use these hyperpalatability techniques on healthy foods? By combining healthy fats, salt, and real proteins, or real umami flavors, we can make our own healthy meals every bit as crave-worthy as the processed food industry makes their junk. Not only will they taste great, they'll give us real satiety, especially if they contain a bit of cholesterol, so we will be less prone to overeating them. So go ahead and use salt. Salting healthy food helps you look forward to the main dish, not just the dessert. And those healthy foods will be even more enjoyable with added flavor from herbs and spices. Herbs and spices. Herbs are vegetable superfoods, packed with even more nutrition per ounce than most other vegetables. But they go bad really fast. So buying fresh herbs puts the pressure on to use them before they turn into compost. One solution to this problem is buying herbs in a pot and growing them yourself. Herbs that grow easily indoors include mint, rosemary, thyme, basil, oregano, chives, and sage. Success with herbs can be the gateway to a bigger and better relationship with gardening, so give it a go. If you're not up for that, then dried herbs are amazing too. A simple Italian herb blend goes a long way to freeing you from dependence on store-bought prepared sauces. Dried herbs retain their minerals, but their vitamins will deteriorate over time. Like herbs, spices are superfoods. Most of them are absolutely loaded with minerals. They're also essential to creating a sense of variety when you only buy a few meats or veggies. By shifting from Mexican to Asian spices, for example, you can make chicken, onions, carrots, mushrooms, and celery taste Tex-Mex or Sichuan. If spices are intimidating, start with a simple blend of something you would eat dining out, such as a curry, a Lebanese seven-spice mix, a dry rib rub, or a Cajun fish blend. Spice blends sold in individual packages are sometimes bulked up with non-nutritive ingredients, such as silicon dioxide and maltodextrin, which are not ideal, but not a deal-breaker either. Most spice blends sold in jars in the spice section of grocery stores are absolutely great. Sprinkle the world of flavor into your food with a tap of your fingertips. Now that you're more familiar with the good foods and not-so-good foods, let's take a look at how to incorporate the good foods into some fast, easy meals that will get you started on the road to metabolic health.